Are you ready? Okay, council will please come back to order. Carla, would you call the roll?
Saltzman?
Here.
Novick?
Here.
Fritz? Fish?
Here.
Hales?
Here.
And we have one item this afternoon. Could you read that item?
Item 708, transmit OIR group report to the City of Portland on Portland Police Bureau officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths.
Welcome, Auditor Griffin-Blade. I want to thank you and the OIR group for a thorough report, and we look forward to hearing your presentation.
Great. Good. Good afternoon. LaVon Griffin-Blade, City Auditor. And I'm here this afternoon to introduce the team from the OIR group, to tell you a little bit about them, and then also a little bit about the process. So, first of all, Mike Giannacco has a law degree from Stanford Law. He's a founding member and chief attorney of the OIR group. Prior to the creation of OIR, Mike served for 6 years as a U.S. attorney in Central California District, and was chief of the Civil Rights Division. And prior to that, he was a federal prosecutor for 8 years for the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. Julie Rulin has a law degree from USC Law. Prior to joining the OIR group, Julie worked for the Police Resource Assessment Center, also known as PARC, in Los Angeles. Prior to that, Julie was a criminal defense and civil rights attorney. And Rob Miller, last but not least, of course, has a law degree from UCLA Law. Prior to becoming the deputy chief attorney of OIR, Rob served for 15 years as a criminal prosecutor in the LA County District Attorney's Office. So the OIR group provides consultant services to various jurisdictions on the West Coast regarding officer-involved shootings, use of force incidents, investigative protocols, force policies, and training, as well as all forms of alleged police misconduct. For example, since 2001, the OIR group has contracted with Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department to review high-profile officer-involved shootings, inmate murders in county jails, and scores of less-than-lethal force incidents on patrol, in jails, and in courts. Other California jurisdictions they have provided such services to include San Diego, Oakland, Pasadena, Torrance, and Palo Alto. This is the third report the OIR group has completed at my request. In 2010, the same team of folks reviewed the closed investigations of the 2006 in-custody death of James Chassie. In 2012, they reviewed the closed investigations of 7 officer-involved shootings. And today, they present the review of the closed investigations of 6 officer-involved shootings, 6 officer-involved shootings, and 1 in-custody death. The oldest of the cases discussed in today's report is nearly 7 years old. Although the city auditor has had the authority to hire outside experts to conduct such reviews since 2002, past practice was to also wait until any civil litigation was resolved. That often took many, many years and created a backlog of cases for expert review. I changed that practice to have more timely reviews of the closed investigations and contracted with OIR Group to conduct a series of reports. We are in the process currently of amending and extending their current contract to cover the 4 older cases remaining in the backlog, as well as other investigations that were closed in 2012 and 2013. The team will be back before you again within the next 9 months or so to present their next report. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Giannacco.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, commissioners, and the general public for the City of Portland. My name is Mike Giannacco. It's good to see some familiar faces and some new ones as well. And I'm pleased to start the dialogue with regard to the release of our second report in a series of 3. As Auditor Griffin Valade said, our first report was a standalone involving an in-custody death of Mr. Chassie. Then we moved on to a series of officer-involved shootings and one in-custody death over a 9-year period of time. And so for almost a decade, we've been looking at shootings that have occurred over a decade span of time. And while certainly some of that historical information is no longer relevant to how the Bureau does its work now and does its review now, it did give us an opportunity to develop a historical perspective and see the evolution of change and reform with regard to the way in which these critical incidents are reviewed. And they are critical incidents. Whenever an officer uses deadly force, it obviously impacts the receiver of that deadly force in a significant and tragic way, no matter what. And it obviously, when an officer uses deadly force, to which we are required to give officers authority to use deadly force, the community has questions about the deployment of that force, whether it was appropriate, whether it met appropriate standards, whether it broke the law, and whether or not the officer was performing consistent with training and the expectations of the Bureau and ultimately the community. We look through each of these incidents through that lens, which is we look at the incident itself to determine whether or not the incident and the performance of the officers before, during, and after the event were consistent with best practices and certainly with the Bureau's expectations and policy. In addition, we look at the actual investigation that the Bureau conducts of these events. Without a thorough and fair objective investigation, the analysis or the conclusions that any Bureau would reach would be impacted in a negative way if the information they are receiving is somehow not objective, not thorough, not fair. We also look at the review process to see whether or not during the review of the investigative materials, the Bureau has taken an objective and critical eye with regard to the performance of its officers, again, both before, during, and after the event, to determine whether or not that critical eye meets professional standards that are expected of policing in today's world and in the United States. I have to say that our review is now two-thirds over. We have, as was stated by the auditor, four more cases to look at, but we have come up with some tentative conclusions. And those conclusions are reported in the first phase of our report, as well as the second one that we are here to talk about today. What we can say is a couple things right off the bat. First, we have done this work for other agencies and other police departments throughout the country. And what we have learned, that it's critical to our work, that our work is only as good as the information we receive. By that, I mean we need access to the internal investigations. We also need access to the people that are making these decisions on behalf of the Bureau, the people that are doing these investigations in the Bureau, as well as other information that is contained in the investigative files. And I can say that in the course of our working now for almost 3 years with the Police Bureau, we have not had any problems in achieving those important goals and objectives. We've received complete cooperation from the Bureau and its command staff all the way up to the chief. We've received candid communications from all involved in both the investigative and review process. Without having that information and that kind of cooperation, we wouldn't be able to do our work effectively. The second thing that I would like to say is that over the course of the decade in which we're looking at officer-involved shootings, the 2004, 2005, 2006 shootings that we looked at compared to today's expectations in 2013 fell below the mark in a number of ways. In some cases, there was no internal investigation whatsoever. It was just reliance on the detective investigation. In some cases, there was really not a robust review administratively to look and see whether or not the incident could become a learning session and also an accountability piece for the Bureau. That wasn't going on so much in 2004, 2005, 2006. But I have to say this. It wasn't going on so much throughout the country for any police agency in 2004, 2005, 2006. So I think it's a symptom of how, as a result of stakeholders such as yourself and the community of Portland and others, that kind of pressure and interest has put increased interest in the Bureau itself to do a better job. And our review preliminarily is that they have started doing a better job. In fact, with regard to their review process, I have to say that it's one of the more robust or most robust review processes we've seen in our experience. We see some of the things that the Bureau does and hold them out as gold standards when we do our work for other agencies. Are they perfect? No. And our second report that we have before you today says as much. There's more to be done. There's more that can be learned. Policies can be improved. The way in which they investigate can continue to be improved. And we use these incidents as evidence in which we hope the Bureau considers our recommendation and implements them so that the next go-around they'll even have a more improved product. Finally, I wanted to talk about a little bit about the theme that we tried to portray with regard to the 7 shootings that are the subject of today's discussion. The theme has to do really with the challenges of modern-day policing. That is, 6 of the 7 officer-involved shootings or in custody deaths involve dynamic situations. An officer is responding to an individual who has attempted to avoid apprehension. There's a pursuit, either a foot pursuit, a vehicle pursuit. There's a need to follow this individual in a way that is consistent with, again, best practices in policing. What we have seen too often are cases in which departments who have a sort of catch-at-all-costs strategy end up finding themselves in a position of peril and then deciding the need to use deadly force as a result of coming up too close to the individual they're pursuing. What we have found is that when officers perform consistent with principles of officer safety, it also reduces the likelihood that deadly force will be used, and it also reduces the likelihood that there will end up needing to be an officer-involved shooting, as well as increasing the safety of the officer. And it comes at little cost. Generally speaking, that doesn't result in a lack of apprehension because smarter officers can perform in a way to contain the situation, contain the individual, and bring the individual into custody without incident. That's what we like to see. With regard to foot pursuits, we make a couple recommendations that we hope and we think would improve these principles of officer safety, such as when an officer goes into foot pursuit, radioing his location or her location. We think that's critical. If a person is out there on an island, no help can be afforded the officer. If the person's out there on an island, the Bureau can't provide additional resources to help that officer perform his or her tasks. Those are the kinds of things that we're looking for, and we are looking for the Bureau to improve. And I'll turn over to my colleagues for just a couple other illustrations of that phenomenon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon. Use of deadly force is usually the end of a chain of events that ultimately resulted in the firing of a gun or other use of deadly force by police. As such, our method is to look at that chain of events, back through all the things most relevant, to see not only whether the best practices were being employed at the time the trigger was pulled, but what led up to it and what decisions, forks in the road, which we have found to be vitally important, may have contributed to a good outcome or a bad outcome, or a less or more desirable outcome, one with the least amount of violence and injury to all concerned. In this particular case, we do have some vehicle pursuits that we have viewed during our time reviewing Portland Police Bureau cases. A vehicle pursuit is one type of pursuit, and it's become somewhat of a science in police work, and that's to the good. By this point in the game, police have learned, often from very bitter experience, that every decision about a pursuit has to be weighed carefully against the possible downside. Are you going to run over somebody in your zeal to pursue somebody for a misdemeanor? Are you going to injure the officers because they're going too fast? Are you going to injure the suspect who you may not be sure or you about whom you may know nothing and not be sure what the reason for the flight is? The good news that we have observed is that Portland Police Bureau definitely has participated in this developing science, as it were, and they show that they're aware of basic management, pursuit management principles in the pursuit that I'll focus on today, which is the Saran case, which resulted in a shooting. The first important aspect of it was the vehicle pursuit. And there was all the hallmarks you want to see, management of the pursuit from the get-go by a sort of detached party, not by somebody actively involved in the suit, in the pursuit, but by a stationary individual of rank who was not part of the action, as it were. Constant updating of the information throughout the pursuit, and generally speaking, a relatively short pursuit. Pursuits should generally be as short as you can safely make them. Portland Police Bureau, their doctrine about vehicle pursuits tends towards the more proactive end of the spectrum within the spectrum of acceptable police practices, and that includes the pit maneuver and the boxing in maneuver, which I'll talk about in a minute. The pit maneuver is a high-stakes operation. At speed, it involves nudging or intentionally ramming the suspect vehicle and hopefully bringing the pursuit to a safe stop at that point and then going from there. In the Saran case, the pit maneuver was executed with all appearances that it was executed within the parameters of Bureau policy. However, it resulted in the upending of the vehicle, the suspect vehicle, which then slid a fair distance on its side and caught fire. This did not incur significant injury on the suspect, who then climbed out of the vehicle and ran, and that resulted in a foot pursuit, which ended with the shooting. But the vehicle pursuit and pit maneuver itself was quite dramatic. That causes us to try and stand back and see what lessons can be learned from this particular maneuver, and in a way, our attempt is to not view everything through the lens of the ultimate event, which was the shooting, because many pit maneuvers and vehicle pursuits, of course, don't result in a shooting. So lessons can be derived from these very dramatic events that aren't limited to shootings and other events that result in the death of a suspect. In this case, we found that while the pit maneuver appeared to be reasonably well executed, it had an unpredictable and unusually dramatic and jarring outcome, which was the vehicle falls over, slides a long way, bursts into flame. And that causes us to recommend that the department should look at pit maneuvers, even successful pit maneuvers, or those that don't seem to result in anything unpredictable, and evaluate them as a very serious use of police force and police technique. In this particular case, speed was the potential issue. This maneuver appeared to be executed at the feather edge of the allowable 45-mile-per-hour speed, but that could never be, or rather it was not, definitely determined because there was no analysis using the available tools. The department has standard accident reconstruction tools at its disposal, as well as a GPS devices that can help it determine speed. So I lay this out really to discuss both the method we use and the way in which we strive to derive usable, exportable lessons from these few but very dramatic incidents called critical incidents. The other thing that came into play that relates to pursuits is the box-in maneuver, which the department employs. Boxing in can be done while moving, but much more often it's simply done when the PPB officers seek to control the potential flight of a vehicle that is stopped or has been stopped. In this case, vehicles came in on at least two sides and prevented it from getting away. That entails what for us is a very debatable officer safety cost-benefit analysis. By driving right up and almost kissing the front or rear bumper of a suspect vehicle, especially a suspect that the Bureau has reason to believe might be armed, the officers put themselves, even if just momentarily, at a moment of extreme vulnerability because they're sitting there trying to control their car and bring it to a stop, and they're going to be looking straight at the person who they feel like they're about to arrest and who obviously is now acutely aware of that plan. For that reason, many, many departments, in our experience, do not allow a boxing in maneuver, certainly at that kind of range, because it's the likelihood of resulting in gunfire, they believe, is greater and an unnecessary risk. We tend to agree with that point of view. It is a debatable point in police operations. I wouldn't say that it's a debate that is fully concluded, but this is our experience and our belief, and therefore we felt obligated to make the recommendation, even though we know that the department disagrees with us. I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, Julie Rulin, to discuss further matters.
Good afternoon. Julie Rulin with OIR Group. I just want to talk briefly about another challenging tactical situation that we've seen often end up in a deadly force, use of deadly force by a police officer, and that many agencies confront, and that is how to deal with a individual who's seated in a car who's not complying with an officer's orders to get out of that vehicle. It came up in two of these seven incidents that we reviewed in this report, one incident that we reviewed in the last report, and another notable case that we haven't reviewed, but we've certainly heard a lot about here in Portland, and that was the Kendra James shooting. In the shooting of Keaton Otis, in one of the cases we review for this report, officers made the decision that the way to handle the situation was to try to pull Mr. Otis out of the vehicle, and one officer did a control hold and attempted to pull him out of the vehicle and ended up himself getting pulled into the vehicle in a very tactically disadvantageous position. The other officers around expressed some surprise when they were interviewed because this officer was strong and large and fit, and they were surprised that he was pulled into the vehicle, when in fact we've seen that again and again, and I think officers tend to underestimate the leverage advantage that a seated person has in attempting, when you're trying to engage that person, and the strength they have via the leverage. We see it in other cases where an officer reaches into a vehicle to try to disable it, and the suspect at that point tries to pull away, and again, the officer's in a very precarious position because the car's moving away and he or she is maybe being dragged along by it, and these kinds of situations often lead to the use of deadly force by the officer. There's really no clear or easy answer as to how to deal with these problems, and We have urged in this report, we've urged the Bureau to lean on its tactical experts to try to develop some comprehensive policy guidelines that would really put them out in front of other large departments because, as I said, this is a problem that many agencies struggle with, and we have yet to see a really good comprehensive way to approach it from a policy and training standpoint. So we've had those discussions with the Bureau, and we're eager to see how that progresses. One other issue I wanted to raise briefly because it has to do with another city agency, and that's the Bureau of Emergency Communications. And we make a recommendation in this report based on our review of the incident that led to the shooting of David Hughes in 2006, where there were some issues with the dispatcher's performance in that case. In our prior report, we noted some issues with the BOEC dispatcher and the way she communicated with the Bureau, and that was in relation to the Derek Collins case from our last report. And in this report, we recommend that the city and the Bureau look at ways in which you might be able to bring BOEC into the police review board process in those cases where the dispatcher's performance or level of communication with the Bureau is an issue. And the Bureau has agreed with that recommendation, and so I would be expecting that they be having that dialogue with city leaders as well.
We will. Thank you.
We're not going to exhaust everybody by going over all the recommendations in the detail that we have this afternoon with regard to those three, but just wanted to sum up by saying that we appreciate the opportunity to, again, work with the Bureau, work with the city, work with the stakeholders. We had very robust discussions earlier this morning with a number of your city stakeholders and appreciate their feedback. The trip coming here is well worth it, just hear from them, hear their perspective, and also to better inform us as we go forward in our review. That being said, we have nothing further to present, but are certainly available to hear any questions from you all and to respond to them.
Great. Thank you for a good report. Questions for the team? Further questions for the team now? Or we may have...
Well,
go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I guess I had a question. You talked about the need for... in your first recommendation, to make sure officers have sufficient training regarding perishable skills. I guess I've never heard that phrase. What are perishable skills?
Commissioner Saltzman, when we talk about, that is a term of art, but perishable skills mean skills that if you don't practice them, you lose the ability to perform consistent with how you've been trained. They deal with tactical decision making, how to come up on a car, using the radio, those kinds of things that patrol officers do every day. And where it runs into difficulty is these specialized units that aren't performing as patrol officers. They're not going to calls. And therefore, in the one case we looked at, when they had to go tactical, they probably could have used some perishable skill training, and it may have improved the way in which they performed that day.
Okay. And then you also mentioned about discouraging the use of using first names during interviews and things like that?
This is really a formatting question, but an officer-involved shooting is obviously a tragic event for those that have lost their loved ones. And what we saw is actually in the reports, the decedent was continually referred to by his first name. We think a more formal approach and using the last name is more desirable.
And then my final question just relating to the box in. So you're saying that was that one where the Bureau disagreed with you?
Yes, it was, Commissioner.
Okay. Yeah. So other jurisdictions are?
I wouldn't say it's unanimous, but many others discourage the box in. They have just found that
you're exposing an officer who's in essence
perpendicular
with somebody behind the wheel.
That gets at a fairly deeply held conviction of all of ours that officer safety, there's a huge overlap between officer safety and good constitutional best practices policing that also provides the maximum protection for the community. When officers are unsafe or put themselves in a more unsafe position, then decision-making can not be optimum, and the likelihood of impulsive or quick decision-making that leads to, in retrospect, what might seem like unnecessary use of firearms or violence can occur more often.
But it does beg the question, so if not the box-in maneuver, then what under those circumstances?
Well, some departments simply don't. If a suspect meets certain criteria, such as, the certain level of seriousness of the suspected behavior, they allow an escape route. Otherwise, some will do a much looser box-in that is a compromise between attempting to discourage flight using the car, but not get so close that you feel that the slightest erratic movement by the suspect driver might put you at deadly risk. You know, when you're doing classic box-in, if you are the police officer and I am the suspect, we're closer than you and I are right now.
I mean, you've said that the pit maneuver obviously can be dangerous, the box-in maneuver can be dangerous, but are there other ways, if you really need to catch somebody and you're chasing their vehicle, that are less dangerous where you can reliably stop them?
We didn't recommend against the pit maneuver. The department has clearly employed the pit maneuver for a long time. The statistics on pit maneuver effectiveness are pretty good, but and safety. But it is a high-stakes maneuver that needs to be scrutinized every time it's used, especially when the outcome is unpredictable, as it was in the case I discussed. And therefore, what we're really recommending is that the department use its capabilities, its ample capabilities, to analyze the pit maneuver, determine exactly what the speeds were, whether they actually complied with department policy, and if there were any other irregularities that could be improved upon.
Other questions? So, Mr. Janocco and Mr. Miller, Ms. Rulin, thank you. Good report. I want to call on the chief to respond, and then we have public testimony. We may have other questions
Certainly.
For you that arise out of that, but thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lamont. So, Chief, come on up. There's a written response for the public. May not know if you haven't seen the document. There's a written response from the Police Bureau in the report itself, but obviously want you to cover some of the points from that and any other additions you want to make to that report that you've already put into the record here, Chief. So,
thank you, Mayor. And just for the record, I'm Mike Reese, Chief of Police, and I brought up with me Larry O'Day, Assistant Chief of Operations, Dave Famous, the Captain of our Professional Standards Division, and Donna Henderson, Assistant Chief of Investigations. I want to thank the Mayor, City Council, and the Auditor for the opportunity to respond to the second report by the OIR group regarding six police officer shootings and one in-custody death. The investigation and review of deadly force encounters and in-custody deaths provides a critical lens with which to view a police department. In no small way, these incidents are where transparency, accountability, and the community's trust in their police officers are measured. This report by the OIR group is another positive step forward in assisting the Police Bureau in building that trust and developing meaningful improvements to how we respond to officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths. As a department, we embrace these changes. And as our written response indicates and the audit points out, we have already implemented many of the suggestions made by OIR. There will always be room for improvement in both the tactical response to these incidents as well as post-incident investigations. The Police Bureau is committed to continuous improvement and complete transparency in how we investigate and analyze these incidents. During the past decade, we have made significant improvements in the way we investigate all uses of force, and we continue to work towards streamlining the effectiveness and the timeliness of our review processes. I would like to thank OIR Group once again for their thorough and professional approach to this review. They continue to provide us with constructive recommendations, as well as highlighting the challenges that critical incidents present to police officers and police departments. And lastly, I want to point out the good work being done by the men and women of our organization every day. These officers respond with courage and a commitment to public service that deserves recognition. In many instances, they put their own lives on the line to protect the safety of our community. I appreciate their hard work and their dedication, and I'm humbled to be the chief of police. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I just want to say I appreciate the format of your response. You were pretty clear. You said agree, and here's what you've done, or disagree, and the community may agree or disagree with your responses, but there's no lack of clarity here, so I appreciate that. And I think the community is well served if you as a bureau are saying, here's where we agree with the reviewers and why we, and where we don't, why we don't, and particularly on the box-in maneuver, as we've already started to discuss, you know, that's a clear difference in practice between what you believe is appropriate and what the reviewers are concerned about. So thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Other questions for the chief or his staff? I don't know if anyone else was going to present at this point or if you're here to respond. So great. Well, thank you. Stand by, and we'll see if there if there's
thank
need
you,
for you to come back up. And then I know we have people signed up to testify. So thanks.
We have eight people signed up. If the first four would come on up. Dan Handelman, Debbie Iona, Fred Bryant, and Joe Walsh.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Hello, Mayor Hales and Commissioners. I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. And you're going to get a summary of our analysis and a full analysis. And I'm wondering if I might have 5 minutes to present today since it's such a long report.
Yeah, your organization, obviously, this is a key issue for you. So we'll deviate from the rules in that case.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Mr. Mayor. So the OIR Group's new report contains some well-directed critiques of several incidents and even some meaningful recommendations, but also a deeply disappointing discussion of race in relation to the Keep Notice case. The report covers Portland's only taser-related death and supports the medical examiner's finding of accidental death without question. We feel the OIR Group relies too heavily on police bureau's perspective. We also feel there should be more local input into these periodic reviews. Nonetheless, the report does challenge the bureau by suggesting alternative ways that incidents could have been handled and noting how long some changes are taking to make. In several cases, the OIR Group chastised officers for putting themselves into a position of danger then using that mistake to justify the use of deadly force. We rephrase this recurring theme to say killing is always a choice for an officer, and it's pretty much never true that they had to shoot someone. The report's focus on reckless tactics, poor supervision, and neglect of officer safety in cases involving car and or foot pursuits suggests that such chases may prompt officers to use deadly force more often. However, OIR once again fails to call for more civilian oversight as a partial remedy for the ongoing problems. Regarding race in the police, OIR brushes off the concern that Otis was racially profiled despite police saying he looked like a gangster, wore a hoodie, didn't fit the car he was driving, and was slouching in the car, without analyzing that these concerns would never have applied to a 20-something white kid in Portland. They also ignored that Otis was followed by police just 3.5 months after Aaron Campbell was shot in the back and killed. In another case, Marcello Veda, I don't know how to pronounce it properly, who was chased after supposedly littering, ended up wounded by many of the 39 bullets two officers fired at him. The OIR group reveals that a commander cleared the officers of wrongdoing based in part on easily disproven fact. He said the officers never lost sight of the young African-American man, which should have ended the chase, but both officers admitted doing just that. And according to our records, these two cases involved the largest number of bullets fired by the police in the last 20 years. We support OIR Group's multiple suggestions to improve the chances of making firing police permanent, as well as using arbitration decisions like the one that reinstated Lieutenant Kerr after he killed Dennis Young, to fix police training and policy. However, we dispute both the assertion that Kerr was in danger of being run over by the car and that no existing policy would have stopped him from leaving his assigned post to go to his sister's house. As with the 2010 report, there's no mention of the outcome of lawsuits. Young's family was awarded $200,000 in a settlement with the city. OIR points out that a civilian had shut off the lane of traffic where Timothy Grant was lying, and thus Officer Paul Park might not have used his taser and punched the man, who was clearly in some kind of crisis, and then he ended up dead. Beyond the report's conclusion, and despite the medical examiner's finding that taser didn't contribute to Grant's death, nobody asked if Grant would still be alive if police had never intervened. OIR stopped short of saying the officer who bumped Scott Saran's van, causing it to flip over and catch fire, should have been investigated for use of deadly force. They raised the questions about the officer who shot Saran at close range with his AR-15 rifle, saying his concerns about Saran's threat level were generic, and we say likely unjustified since Saran was both unarmed and had committed robberies using a fake gun found destroyed in the burned-out van. In another case, the officer who shot Osmar Lovena Bermudez, again, don't know about pronunciation, after he ran from a shed that officers filled with six canisters of gas, was hiding behind a tree, fired sight unseen through a fence, and ended up hitting a nearby apartment with the AR-15 bullet that passed through the Latino man, wounding him. The OIR's recommendation in this section was to use negotiation before weapons, which also applies to the recent death of Merle Hatch, whom the police never engaged in dialogue before killing him. In the shooting of unarmed fugitive David Hughes, who was trapped between two buildings and two fences, the police confronted and shot him at close range. OIR refers to Hughes, who was unmistakably suicidal, as paranoid for thinking the police were after him, even though officers had visited his hotel room earlier in the day. They wisely point out the 911 operator who didn't connect him to an officer who had a past relationship with Hughes should have been part of the Bureau's review of that case. Conversely, an emergency operator was doing well talking to Bradley Morgan in 2012 before police arrived and shot him, but no outsider review of that case might be done until at least 2015. As noted in our response to last year's OIR report, the group should refrain from repeating the term suicide by cop because when one person kills another, it's always a homicide, and this term reinforces the idea officers have no choice. The report fails to see that with no true civilian oversight, Portland's system is still too incestuous for officers to be held accountable. In other potential misconduct cases, the Bureau finds more complaints sustained based on officer complaints than civilians, is reluctant to hand down discipline in cases using deadly force. We urge caution in moving forward with the OIR group's suggestion to shorten commander memos rather than changing the system that lets them vote on their own recommendations. We call for more civilian oversight to include investigations of deadly force and appeals to the CRC. We support quite a number of OIR's other recommendations. We take issue with others, and we're thankful for the new and generous use of shooter officer names and ask for the auditor, it sounds like she's going to do this, to allow OIR to review shootings from 2011 to 2013 in next year's final report.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Debbie Iona, representing the League of Women Voters, Portland. We have been involved in police oversight since one of our past presidents served on the Stores Commission that proposed the city's first oversight agency over 30 years ago. We'd like to start by thanking Auditor Griffin Vallade for facilitating this review. The report discusses throughout shortcomings in the training division analyses. These analyses, done well, potentially provide critical guidance for needed changes to policy and training. The OIR report indicates the analyses have improved, but they could be better. As a complement to the Bureau's efforts to improve the analyses, the League recommends tapping into the Training Advisory Council and the CRC for supplemental assessment. Using the OIR report as a guide, the advisory committees could study recent analyses and report back to the Bureau on how they measure up to the concerns outlined by OIR. OIR explains that reviews of officer-involved shootings should identify potential training, policy, supervision, and equipment issues. The 2010 Police Oversight Stakeholder Committee recommended adding such policy-related issues to findings in all investigated cases. To date, we have seen no evidence this recommendation is being followed in cases that come before the CRC. In light of OIR's emphasis on such factors, these ratings should be included in all investigated cases. The lessons learned from a broad evaluation that goes beyond specific allegations can point the way to improvement. It has been 10 years since the first Park report on police shootings was released. Park evaluated the implementation of its recommendations in its follow-up reports. CRC issued a Park follow-up report in 2010 that addressed only two out of the four reports. OIR states, quote, "The internal review processes must be accompanied by efforts to make substantive modifications in the way officers act and make decisions in the field," close quote. It's time for a look back at past recommendations to determine if, indeed, officers have made substantive modifications in the field. The report emphasizes the need to step back, plan, wait, and bring in more officers. Unlike suspects, police officers have the advantage of personnel, training, equipment, and communications. The Bureau should continue working to use those advantages effectively in order to reduce the number of tragic endings for both the suspects and the officers. Thank you, and you'll find additional points in our written testimony.
Thanks, Debbie. Thanks very much. Afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Fred Bryant, father of Keaton Otis. 3 years, and I still am baffled and confused. I read the OI report, and there were some things in there that, you know, I've said all the time, you know, that information was not given, it was withheld. Medical examiner's reports were not completely filled out. Things were said to me that I know is not true. We know for a fact that, you know, my son was profiled. They say it themselves. And I'm just still baffled after 3 years. Why does this continue to, well, let me say it like this. I'm pretty smart, okay? And what is put before me and what I see is what I see. And then when somebody tries to tell me something else different, when I know it ain't true, it really irritates me a lot. You know, people need to be held accountable for their behavior, period. And as everybody knows, my son was just driving down the street. As everybody knows, these officers were just sitting in the coffee shop. Okay, my son is 6'5", 165 pounds. He's driving a Toyota Corolla. He's going to slouch his scoot down so he can drive. You know, I've lived in this city my whole life, 53 years, and I've seen it all. But what I have not seen is accountability. I'm a taxpayer, and you know, I deserve the truth. I deserve honesty. In any big organization, there's going to be problems. But if you see the problem, hold somebody accountable for it. Don't keep brushing it off, because that's what I see. You know, I see a video of officers talking and my son talking, and everybody else says I'm lying. But it's right on the video. It's right there. You know, I don't know. I'll be talking about this till I don't breathe anymore, because I have 11 grandchildren, African-American grandchildren, in this city. And we need to stop fluffing each other up and just do the right thing, period. You expect us to do the right thing, and we try. We expect you to do the same thing. You know, I'll never see my son again, and I'm getting okay with that. But for future, we really need to do something different right now. Thank you.
My name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. I would refer you to the Otis case also, starting on page 79. If you go to page 84 first, my argument with the police department is, why in God's name did you even stop this man? If you look down that list, it says, Mr. Otis seemed to say, do you know what I know? That's looking from one car to the other. There's no verbal. It's just a police officer deciding that Mr. Otis had this, do you know what I know? Mr. Otis, he had a hoodie. Sound familiar? We just went through a national trauma that involved a hoodie. I'm not going to go into the whole case of Trayvon Martin, but it's the same crap. You know, let me tell you a story. When I get up in the morning and I have to go to the store, it's a hassle. I'm on oxygen, I walk with a limp, I need a cane, it's a hassle. But I'm a white male, and I never in my 71 years ever thought of the fact that I may not return home because a police officer shot me. Think about that. Every one of you on this council never had that thought. The people of color have it every day. And this city has a problem. This city can have all the reports you want, but until you change the way these police officers back there with their guns look at people, nothing's going to change. I had an incident with a police officer. I went up and asked him for his card, his business card. Now, that's a very routine thing. He was a sergeant. He looked at me and he said, no, my police officers are not going to give you the card. I will give you mine, but they are not going to give you the card. That's violation of policy. You all know that. I knew it. But it wasn't a big incident. Did I file a complaint? No. Because the police officer's attitude is they don't care. Because you do nothing. And the commission does nothing. Until the people of Portland can elect an independent commission to investigate these crimes, these reports that you have, you can wipe your ass with. Because they're worthless. Thank you.
Next, please.
Next four are Kathy Bushman, Joanne Hardesty, Barbara Ross, and Crystal Ilinski.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Go ahead. My name is Kathleen Bushman, and my problem is that this issue of police accountability is a very low bar. I hear that there is self-congratulatory comments from the police department about how much they've improved their accountability. I'm not impressed, and I'm not surprised either, because you have officers in supervisory positions who, well, beginning with the neo-Nazi at the precinct level, you have another one involved in a road rage incident and sexual harassment who remains in a supervisory position. Until they're setting a tone for the entire police department. So to me, that the police do not think they should be accountable is not surprising. I think what we need to do, and this has occurred to me, I think it's a possible solution, rather than, I think, wonder if all the supervisory positions in our police department just be replaced with elected officers based on their previous record of showing good judgment in the use of force. We should not be promoting officers who have shown poor use of judgment. But they are not only promoted and allowed to remain on the job, they sometimes remain in supervisory positions, and that needs to change.
Thank you. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Mayor, City Council members. For the record, my name is Joanne Hardesty, and I want to thank the OIR group for the second of three reports. I also want to share my colleagues that spoke earlier's disappointment in the fact that these reports simply don't go far enough. And I want to point out a couple of examples of where I think there's a disconnect. Fred Bryant talked about his son, Keaton Otis, and I think I think page 84 gives you a snapshot into the mind of the individual officers who made the decision that day to pull Keaton Otis over. If any of you had happened to have on a hoodie and were scrunched down in the car, I don't know that they would have made the same assessments, that he looked at me like, as if to say, do they know what I know? I mean, how do you look at someone with that thought? Did he transmit it through osmosis to the car that was next to him? The fact that they said that he looked like he might be a gang member, that wasn't because of the hoodie. It wasn't because of the car. And so because we refuse to address the racial profiling that takes place when the gang enforcement unit comes out with 10 officers that respond to do a traffic stop, I'm not surprised that Keaton Otis is dead. I'm just surprised that more young people aren't dying at the hands of police. Have you witnessed how the gang enforcement unit does their job? If you have not, I encourage you to do that. I also want to make a point about one of the, and so that was my point about this page. Each of these statements are racially biased statements that were used collectively to decide that Keaton Otis must be stopped. That is not appropriate, and I'm disappointed that we continue to shine away from the issue of race. The OIR group says they don't think that these stops are racially motivated, but it's not rocket science. And Keaton Otis isn't the first or last person to lose their life that were African-American men at the hands of police because they didn't look like they belonged in the neighborhood they were killed in. The last point I want to make is about recommendation 9 talks about the bill should revise its directives to expressly state that unsatisfactory performance, blah, blah, blah. I have 12 seconds left. So what I want to highlight is that the chief says that this is already part of the agreement, that the supplemental language in the directives for employment for the collective bargaining that allows us to fire cops for these reasons that are listed. If that were true, we wouldn't keep rehiring cops that we have fired for this particular behavior. And so I think it's important that someone outside of the police bureau reviews this document and not just take Portland Police Bureau's word that they've already implemented or made these changes. Because if it's true, Fresh Hour wouldn't be sitting home getting paid today. Thank you.
I'll get the chief to respond, Joanne, but I think what he said is that they're implementing some of these disciplinary and training provisions already and are attempting to bargain them in the collective bargaining process, which we're in right now. Obviously, whatever.
But that's not what it says here. It says here that this is supplemental language that's in the directives right now.
Right. The police chief has issued those directives, but we are also in bargaining. So we haven't completed bargaining. Whatever happened in all of these incidents happened under current and previous management and under the existing contract, which is now lapsed because we got to the end of the year. So we're in bargaining now. We hope to conclude that and have all these changes incorporated in the new collective bargaining agreement.
I hope so, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor and City Commissioners. My name is Barbara Ross, and I'm here testifying as an individual, not representing any group. This is a really good, thorough report and helps us look at these cases in detail, both from the officer's point of view and from a policy point of view. I'd like to call your attention to one thing, and that's the unnecessary delay in completing investigations. There are a lot of things about these cases, these tragic cases, that are not under control. But the length of the investigation is, And the report outlines the number of months that it took to complete these reports. Marcella Vida, 14 months. Dennis Young, 16 months. Timothy Grant, 14 months. Scott Saran, 20 months. David Hughes, 23 months. Benavides, 7 months. Kent Notice, 7 months.